Up next, it's Weekend All Things Considered. And a little bit of traffic. Steve Herrera is here one last time for him tonight with a problem in the East Bay.
Yes, hi, Sandy. In Oakland, westbound Highway 24 before Highway 13, crews have the right lane blocked before the ramp to southbound 13 due to a two-vehicle crash, including one that overturned on its roof. Southbound 101 at the Golden Gate Bridge toll plaza, a flatbed truck hit the toll booth. Bridge crews are cleaning up oil that went into the storm drain. And be careful in Sunnyvale, southbound 101 at Fair Oaks. There's 20 to 30 bricks in the two right lanes. I'm Steve Herrera for KQED.
And support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA Enterprise Software Platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 5 p.m.
Israeli forces rescued four hostages in Gaza today, the biggest rescue since the war began. But the operation came with a high toll and many deaths in a civilian neighborhood. Our producer was on the scene. For Saturday, June 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We'll also head to Germany, where on the eve of European Parliament elections, thousands rallied against the far-right political parties that may see a big victory at the ballot box.
Yeah, I fear the right will get more votes than last time.
We'll also get the latest on the two big private space rocket launches from this week and hear from the so-called double disapprovers who don't like either major political party candidate this year, how they could decide the outcome of the election. And also, AI beauty pageants.
I would like to see somebody of a different gender, somebody larger, older, with flaws.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Gaza health officials say more than 200 Palestinians were killed, 400 injured in the Israeli military operation that rescued four hostages held by Hamas. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, witnessed the scene and a warning. This report contains gunfire and graphic descriptions of violence.
Anas was in Nusayrat on Saturday morning when he heard gunfire from helicopters and explosions. He ducked for cover with Palestinian civilians. "We are all going to die," one person shouted. "May God punish Hamas, who is the reason for all of this," yelled another. When Anas emerged, he found the streets covered with blood. A nearby hospital was overwhelmed. In a video Anas sent, bodies lined the hallways. The Israeli military says the four rescued hostages were being held in the, quote, heart of a civilian neighborhood. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Meanwhile, pro-Palestinian protesters gathered outside the White House fence today demanding an end to the war in Gaza and an end to U.S. support for Israel. The demonstration prompted increased security measures, including the installation of anti-scaling fencing. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg says he's willing to testify before Congress, but only after former President Trump's sentencing hearing. And Pierce Jimena Bustillo has more.
Republican Representative Jim Jordan called on Bragg to testify before a select congressional committee focusing on what he calls the weaponization of the federal government. The request came a day after a New York jury convicted Trump of 34 felony counts of falsified business records. In his response, Bragg said that he would cooperate, but only after Trump's July sentencing hearing. In his letter, Bragg said that to testify before then would be potentially detrimental to, quote, protecting fair administration of justice. Trump and his allies have, without evidence, argued that the trial and now verdict are politically motivated, and he has made the false claim that the federal government is behind the trial. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
The heat dome settling over the West is drying out the vegetation and increasing the risk of wildfires. A new study finds the smoke from those fires can be deadly. NPR's Alejandra Burunda has more.
Rachel Connolly grew up in wildfire-prone California. She remembers playing water polo in high school under hazy red skies.
We were still sitting outside, sitting on the pool deck, breathing in that air.
Now she's a scientist at UCLA, leading a new study on smoke's health impacts. It found that between 2008 and 2018, more than 50,000 people died from wildfire smoke exposure in California. 2018 was the year the town of Paradise burned to the ground.
The 2018 campfire in Northern California killed at least 85 people.
The new research suggests another 12,000 died from the effects of smoke that year. Alejandra Burunda, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman. A long-awaited light rail extension connecting East San Jose to BART is now officially under construction. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara reports from the groundbreaking ceremony today.
The 2.4-mile expansion will extend the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority's Orange Line by two stops, providing East San Jose residents with a route to Milpitas where they can transfer to BART.
2.5 miles may not sound like much.
That's San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan.
But if you've ever taken a walk in the hot sun with a bag of groceries in one hand and a child in the other, you know that this connector will be life-changing.
The project is decades in the making. Voters approved a tax measure in 2000 that provided $313 million of the project's funding. But political leaders at the groundbreaking say it was a constant battle to secure further funding and prevent the project from being abandoned. Danny Garza, president of the Plata Arroyo Neighborhood Association, says the east side of San Jose, which is a heavily Latina area, has suffered from decades of underinvestment.
Race has always been a role here in the East Valley. Why do you think we're 24 years late? It's because the other people on the other side of town, I don't care what race they are, I don't care what color they are, they ignored the families in the East Valley. That's not going to happen anymore.
The project will add two new stations at Story Road and East Ridge Transit Center. Construction is expected to take 4 years to complete. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
And there's more online at kqed.org. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. And support for NPR comes from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And the listeners of KQED. Partly cloudy this evening, mostly cloudy overnight, lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, some clouds in the morning, becoming a sunny day. Highs in the 70s. This is KQED Public Radio.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Israeli forces rescued four hostages from Gaza earlier today in an action that Israeli officials described as a complex special daytime operation. It's the first hostage rescue since February and the largest since the war began, but the operation came at a cost. At least 200 Palestinians were killed, according to a nurse at a nearby Gaza hospital. One Israeli Special Forces police officer was also killed. We're going to talk about this with NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, who's been following this all from Tel Aviv. And before we do that, a warning that this report will contain some graphic details and sounds of gunfire. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Scott.
Tell us more about this hostage rescue, specifically who was rescued.
Yeah, so the four hostages are three men and one woman. They range in age between 21 and 40, and all of them were kidnapped by Hamas-led militants from the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. They're said to be in good medical health. The Israeli military says that it's been planning for this specific operation for weeks. There were multiple agencies involved. An Israeli military spokesperson said the hostages had been rescued under fire and that they were held in the, quote, heart of a civilian neighborhood.
Let's talk more about that civilian neighborhood. This happened in a heavily populated area, and a few hours after this rescue was announced, we started getting details about the scene on the ground in Gaza. What do we know?
So this happened in Nusayrat. It's a city in central Gaza, which has been in the thick of a new operation that Israel launched in the area this week. There's a large population of displaced people there. It's where a lot of people have fled from Rafah in the south in the last few weeks. Our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, was actually staying there this morning, and he witnessed the whole scene. And once we were able to make contact with him, he started sending us video after video and voice messages, you know, showing us what he was experiencing.
Tell us more about what you learned from Anas.
Yeah, so first I'd like to say that Anas is okay, and we're really grateful for that. But he told us that the morning was pretty calm when suddenly helicopters appeared and there was gunfire and explosions. He managed to roll tape while he was running for cover and sheltering with Palestinian civilians. And I just want to play some of that here for you, Scott, so you can get a sense of it. So you can hear people scrambling for cover, kids wailing. At one point, someone is just yelling, why in Arabic. And someone else says, we're all going to die. In another clip that he sent us, people are praying, calling out to God to save them. And one man says, may God punish Hamas, who is the reason for all of this. Eventually, the fighting quieted down and Anas emerged, and he found the streets were just covered with blood. He sent us video of that so we could see it. And then he went to Al-Aqsa Hospital, which was overwhelmed with casualties. Again, in videos he sent, we could see bodies just lining the hallways.
Who else was he able to talk to?
So Anas spoke to a couple eyewitnesses. One was a man whose house was just 50 feet or so from where the rescue happened. He's 60-year-old Mohammed Abdulwahid, and here's what he told us. He said that after the Israeli troops left the scene, the Israeli military started to shell the entire area, bombing the house they raided, but also all around, hitting civilian cars and shops. He said, quote, they destroyed the place totally.
And that was after they left, he said.
Yes, exactly. And now the Israeli military says that Hamas used civilians as human shields here, and there wasn't a way to rescue the hostages without hurting civilians because Hamas embedded the hostages in a civilian area. A military spokesman said the hostages were held inside locked rooms and apartments with families inside and security guards holding weapons outside.
Look, this comes at a time when there is so much pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government to get these hostages back to Israel from the hostages' families, from people throughout the country. There's often a lot of criticism saying not enough is being done.
Yeah.
What has the family's reaction been to this?
So the Hostage Family Forum, the group that represents hostage families, put out a statement immediately after calling the operation today heroic, but also calling on the Israeli government to continue their commitment to getting all 120 hostages still in Hamas captivity in Gaza out, you know, dead or alive. I'll also say the families of these four hostages, the ones who were rescued this morning, are relieved and really grateful. And just generally, you know, people in Israel were cheering in the streets today. It's a big boost to public morale, especially after last week when the Israeli military pronounced four other hostages dead.
There's been so much focus on political pressure on Netanyahu. That was possibly going to come to a head today. Any sense what this could mean for him going forward?
Well, there has been this growing pressure here from the Israeli public and others to get the hostages home. You know, a lot of Israelis feel that the main focus should be pausing the war and securing another hostage deal. It's a main part of that three-part plan that President Biden put forth last week, which Netanyahu has yet to agree to. But this is already having some political effect, like you mentioned. Benny Gantz, who is a member of Netanyahu's three-person war cabinet, also his biggest rival, was expected to resign today. But after this news about the hostages came out, Gantz postponed any announcement. So this could take some of the pressure off Netanyahu, at least for the time being, but I think it's still a little too early to tell.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
And, of course, thank you also to our producer on the ground in Gaza helping us report this story and so many others throughout this war, Anas Baba. Earlier this week, the U.S. shocked the cricket world by beating powerhouse Pakistan in the T20 Cricket World Cup. As Pakistan looks to stay alive in the tournament, it has a pivotal match tomorrow in New York against its bitter rival, India. As deep as their rivalry runs, there is one thing their fans do agree on, though, that biryani, the South Asian rice dish, is the best thing to eat at a cricket match. Kunwar Khuldoon Shahid has the story.
Recently, I went to East Meadow, where India and Pakistan will play on June 9. The biryani shops in the area were buzzing with anticipation.
In Nasa County, there's a big population of Indian people, big population of Pakistani people.
Naveed Haroon is the owner of the Spice and Curry. He's Pakistani, but his customer base comes from all over the subcontinent. One of the restaurant's oldest customers, Saad, is excited about watching cricket and eating biryani right next to the Nassau County Cricket Stadium.
It would be a huge in-demand item, and they're probably going to need to step up their game for the supply part. But yeah, biryani and cricket, they go hand in hand, man.
Biryani became associated with cricket partly because of the sport's format. The oldest version lasts 5 days. Fans eat multiple meals from early morning till evening each day. The breaks in the play are even named after mealtimes. The World Cup format is much shorter, about as long as a baseball game. But in any format of cricket, there's a long pause before each play. It's the perfect amount of time to scoop meat, rice, yogurt, and other condiments onto a spoon. Most South Asian immigrants, like Saad, cherish the fact that in the US, they get to enjoy biryani from both India and Pakistan, which is not possible in the countries of their origin.
All the Desis love biryani, whether it's from Bombay or like Sindhi biryani or whichever one you prefer.
However, like cricket, the Indo-Pak rivalry plays out over biryani as well. Vegetarian biryani is more popular in India, along with chicken and mutton, but not beef, which most Hindus avoid. In Pakistan, meat biryani is more common, but never pork, which is forbidden in Islam. Despite hardliners defining vegetarianism and meat eating through the Hindu-Muslim dichotomy, historian Anil Maheshwari stresses that these labels are not just bigoted, but also inaccurate.
The best mutton is prepared by the Hindu caste. They adopted the dress of the Muslims. They adopted the language of the Muslim. They love their mutton, biryani.
And he notes that in the US, people from the Indian subcontinent ignore their food differences and see their commonalities.
Outside Indian subcontinent, they are Asian.
In East Meadow, I experienced this firsthand when I got to go inside Spice and Curry's kitchen to cook biryani for a dining room full of Pakistani and Indian customers. First up, we put oil into a deg, a large pot. Then we add a bag of dried onions. Then in goes fresh tomato puree and many, many spices, including red chili powder, turmeric powder, and zira coriander. Once the sauce is ready, we add basmati rice. Meat or vegetables are separately added to create meat and vegetarian biryanis. I take a bite of the chicken biryani.
Outstanding. Tastes absolutely amazing.
It takes me right back to cricket games in the subcontinent. To complete the Indo-Pak biryani experience, I walked across to the Indian-owned The Royale, restaurant and bar. The Royale has both devout Hindus and Muslims as regulars, even though it serves alcohol, which is forbidden in Islam, and meat options, which religiously vegetarian Hindus would avoid. First things first, I had to eat authentic Indian biryani from Hyderabad, which is so hard to find in Pakistan.
Wow. Oh, it's packed with flavor. Absolutely delicious.
Owner Amrinder Singh says, what is truly subcontinental is embracing diversity, which he expects to see at the Cricket World Cup as well.
The food is going to unite the love, no matter what kind of rivalry they have on the field. When they'll be back, they'll enjoy the food.
Pakistan and India will meet Sunday in the Cricket World Cup. And no matter the score, the stands selling biryani are sure to come out on top. For NPR News, I'm Kumar Khuldoon Shahid.
As we celebrate those we love as they get on in the years, we often like to focus on all of the good they do. But that is not necessarily the case for one of Walt Disney's most beloved characters, who turns 90 tomorrow. That, of course, is Donald Duck, a character who was allowed to act in ways that Disney's top star just couldn't.
Mickey Mouse would never provoke a fight or anything like that. Well, Donald Duck didn't have any restrictions like that. His bad temper came to the surface right away. And I think Walt kind of got a kick out of that. So he encouraged that kind of bad behavior in Donald.
NPR's Weekend Edition looks back at the legacy of the bad-tempered and much-loved Donald Duck as he turns 90. That's tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha Roscoe. Turn on your smart speaker and listen on your member station. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Main Library, presenting Ralph Chizay, A San Francisco Century, The Untold Story of the Renaissance Man, Coit Tower Muralist and Father of the Children's Program, Brother Buzz, sfpl.org to plan your visit. Listen to KQED throughout each weekday for clues to our 5:48 p.m. news quiz. And when you hear the quiz question, go to kqed.org/radionewsquiz to enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay with our sponsor, Canyon Ranch Woodside. And good luck.
People will surmount any challenge, conquer any obstacle standing in the way for money, fame, sex, or power. But on the next Snap Judgment, the war is on for who wears it best. The biggest hair battle in the universe, Snap Judgment. Do Nah.
miss it.
Snap Judgment, coming up at 9 o'clock tonight.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel rescued four hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th. The military says they were transferred to a hospital in Israel. Around 120 hostages remain in Gaza, though it's not clear if they are all alive. Gazan health officials say more than 200 people were killed in the Israeli raid. In Europe, voters are choosing a new European Parliament with elections in all 27 member countries. These elections have been going on since Thursday and end tomorrow. Turnout is expected to hit at least 50% across the EU. And a new Biden administration rule will require new vehicles sold in the U.S. to average around 38 miles per gallon. That's up from 29 miles per gallon this year. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support of education, democracy, and peace. More information at Carnegie.org. And by the listeners of KQED. Good afternoon, I'm Sandy Althaus. The time now is 5:20.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It is election weekend in much of Europe as hundreds of millions of voters head to the polls in the European Union parliamentary election that is held every 5 years. In the run-up to this year's vote, there has been a marked increase in violence against politicians and those who work for their campaigns. We're joined now by NPR's Central Europe correspondent, Rob Schmitz, to chat about this. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Scott.
So you spent the afternoon at a pro-democracy demonstration in Berlin that attracted thousands of people. And this comes a day before Germans vote in the EU election. What were people saying?
Yeah, for the most part, people came out because they're genuinely worried about the rise of the far right and what that would mean for Europe. 42-year-old Gwendolyn Stilling, a social worker in Berlin, was one of many thousands who attended the demonstration along the thoroughfare that leads up to Berlin's Brandenburg Gate.
Yeah, bin heute hier auf der Demo, weil ich wirklich in Sorge bin.
And Scott, she's saying here that she came today because she's worried about the threat of right-wing extremists to Europe's open and diverse society, and that she's also worried that should the far right take power, they'll start to exclude minority groups, and that we cannot let this happen.
This has been a trend that we've been observing for years and years at this point. How likely is it that Europe's far-right parties will do well in this weekend's election?
Well, if you look at the polls, they're saying that far-right parties should make many gains across the board. But, you know, in recent weeks, those same polls have told a more nuanced story. I spoke to another protester, Robert Behrens, who came out because he's hoping to convince others to vote. Here's what he said.
I feel that the right will, get more votes than last time, but I hope that all the voices the last weeks that tried to raise up against the right had some impact and that there will be a strong vote still for democracy.
And Behrens's hopes here are not too naive. You know, we've seen preliminary results already in the Netherlands where, you know, voters were the first Europeans to head to the polls on Thursday, and exit polls show that left-wing parties actually narrowly edged out a popular nationalist right-wing bloc of parties.
Interesting. I want to ask you about something else that you've been covering for us, and that is this uptick in political violence that we've been seeing. A lot of examples here, but just yesterday, the Danish prime minister was assaulted in a public square in Copenhagen. Why is this happening?
Yeah, this has been a really chilling wave of violence this election season. You know, you mentioned Danish prime minister Mette Frederiksen. She was shoved so hard yesterday that she suffered whiplash. But police are still sorting out whether that was politically motivated or not. But, you know, we've seen so many other attacks. Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico was shot several times by a man who had political motives. He survived. And here in Germany, we've seen dozens of attacks by extremists on politicians who they do not agree with. And that sent several politicians to the hospital. Political observers think social media is behind much of this, but also a very tense political atmosphere in Europe due to Russia's war in Ukraine and the economic upheaval the war has created throughout this continent. Mm-hmm. It's been a really tough few years for Europeans, and we're likely to see how these tensions manifest themselves when we see election results starting tomorrow evening.
That's NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz joining us from Berlin. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Many Americans say they don't want to vote for either President Biden or former President Trump this year. These so-called double disapprovers will likely sway the race. So NPR correspondents Mara Liasson and Susan Davis wanted to know a little bit more about these voters and what, if anything, will help them decide who they'll vote for. To find out, NPR partnered with focus group expert Rich Tao of the public opinion research firm Engages and Sago, a market research firm. Tao talked to 12 voters in two groups. Every one of them had switched their votes from Trump in 2016 to Biden in 2020, and they mostly reside in the swing states where that matters, the states that will determine the election. The focus groups took place at the end of May, and it's important to note that was before the verdict in Trump's hush money trial. You might think that outcome might have made a big difference in how people felt, but honestly, it didn't. Only one person said they would change their vote based on the outcome of the trial. Mara Liasson and Susan Davis join me now in the studio to talk about what they found. It's like a reunion here. Hey, thanks
Scott,
for coming.
Yeah, happy to be here. Great to see you.
Nice to talk to you. So, Sue, let's start with you. Can you tell us more about these voters and why you wanted to hear from them directly?
Sure. I mean, you most commonly hear these people referred to as double haters, although that's not quite accurate. It's probably more accurate to call them double disapprovers.
But it's fun to say haters.
It is fun to say haters. It's easier. It's clearer. And according to our own polling, the latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, they make up about 14% of the electorate in this election. And in that survey, it shows them nearly evenly divided between the two candidates, mm-hmm. Biden and Trump. The last time the double hater or double disapprover voting percentage was this high was back in the 2016 election between Trump and Hillary Clinton, and they broke pretty decisively towards Trump then. It was a much smaller slice in 2020, only about 3%, but it's been driven way back up, largely driven by President Biden's approval ratings going down. And yeah. One thing to remember here, Scott, this is not an exact science. This is what we would call anecdata. Polls use a scientific method to tell us how many voters feel this way, but a focus group gets at why they do, and that is what we wanted to hear more about.
Right. So Mara, though, what exactly, how can we quantify the negativity toward both Biden and Trump for these two voters?
I think we can quantify it as very high. Yeah. All 12 of them said that they'd replace both of these candidates on the ballot if they could. For most of these voters, the choice seems to be between the guy they think is too old and the guy they think is too dangerous. There is a difference, however, in the way that these voters describe each candidate. Rich Tao did some word association exercises, and when it came to Biden, people said, were more ambivalent. One of them said, I feel sorry for him. Somebody said, not a fan. Somebody else said, well, he's trying. But for Trump, the adjectives were much harsher. Somebody said they'd vote for a brick rather than him. They said Trump only looks out for himself and his rich friends. So that suggests that Biden has a little bit more potential. The red flags are clearly bigger for Biden. He's the incumbent. So far, this is a referendum on the incumbent election. He wants to turn it into a choice. He always says, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. But it shows that he still has an opportunity to bring some of these people back. They're not as angry about him as they are about Trump.
Okay. So, Sue, I feel like this clear theme that we've heard is voters saying, I wish there were other choices. I feel like even when you talk to voters, they say, well, if these are the two choices, both of these men at this point are the party's presumptive nominees. Unless something wildly off the charts happens between now and November, these are the choices Americans have. So given that, which way are people like this leaning?
If the election was today, Biden has a clear advantage. 7 of the 12 said they would vote for Joe Biden today. But the real risk here is third parties. When these same voters were given the options of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Cornel West, and Jill Stein, the support for Biden dropped down to 5 of the 12. And that would suggest that third parties or other options on the ballot are a bigger risk to the incumbent president. It's also interesting, Scott, because when these voters were asked who they thought would win, not who they want to win, but if they had to place a bet on who would win, they were much more decisive. 8 of the 12 said they believed Donald Trump was going to win this election. And I think that highlights how even among likely Biden voters, people say they will vote for him. They still have very low confidence he can win.
Samara, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are very different candidates. I think that's pretty clear. But they are also offering very different visions for this country. If voters are not satisfied with the people themselves, how do they feel about what they're campaigning on?
Well, that is a really good question because they have no idea what Biden's vision is for a second term. Of the 12 people, only one person could cite one thing that Biden had pledged to do in his second term. They do know what Trump has pledged to do. People said, well, he's said he's going to be a dictator on day one, or he's going to have no qualms about using the Justice Department to prosecute his enemies, or, you know, deport millions of illegal immigrants. So they're really drawing a blank when it comes to what Biden has pledged to do. And what we think we know from covering politics for years and years is that the guy with the more positive vision of the future is supposed to be the one with an advantage. And right now, President Biden has really failed to communicate that to voters. Here's what some of our focus group participants said about what Trump wants to do in a second term.
Okay, Juanita, what does he pledge to do?
Take America back, fix our economy, create more jobs.
Kimberly?
Cut off aid to Ukraine. But also, he did just say that he was considering legislation to control birth control.
Brian?
Repeal the ACA and privatize Social Security.
Bob?
Lower corporate taxes even more.
What was yours, Jennifer?
I think he's still wanting to fix the immigration issues. So he's saying, you know, maybe it's not so much about the wall, but he's going to fix the immigration issues.
Now, some of those were negatives for these people, obviously. Yeah.
This is really interesting because the first Biden term has been full of concrete policy, and Trump is by and large running on this idea of retribution and revenge. He's not out there giving white papers about what he wants to do if he returns to the Oval Office, but the flip side seems to be what voters are hearing.
That's right. And one of the things that is going to characterize this election is negative partisanship. Because both of these guys are unpopular, they're going to be relying on convincing people that they need to go into the voting booth to stop someone from being president, not necessarily because they're thrilled about the candidate they're voting for. So you're going to hear a lot of messages about all the horrible things that Trump wants to do from the Biden campaign and vice versa.
So this is interesting. On one hand, voters seem to really dislike Donald Trump. On the other hand, they seem to be ambivalent or disappointed or not having much of an impression at all at Joe Biden. And yet Joe Biden is here viewed as the weaker of the two candidates. Mara, how does a candidate change that between now and November?
Well, I think you're going to see Biden trying. He already has been trying to turn this election from a referendum on the incumbent, which is what reelection campaigns are usually about, into a choice. He wants it to be a choice between him and Donald Trump. He wants to remind people of all the things they didn't like about Trump. And the reason why I think this focus group and our polling shows that he has more of an uphill climb than Trump is because it's almost June. He spent tens of millions of dollars trying to do this, and so far he has not been able to change enough people's minds. Yes, there's still 5 months left, and the Biden campaign constantly says people still haven't tuned in. They're really not focused on Donald Trump. But at some point, if he's going to change this election from a referendum on the incumbent, him, and he's a historically unpopular incumbent, to a choice between two unpopular people, he doesn't have a whole lot of time left.
Mara Liasson, Susan Davis, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
Early adolescence is a time when kids are becoming more independent and spending more time on social media. When it comes to curbing screen time in this age group, new research suggests that what parents do really matters. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
I'm the parent of a tween and a young teen. So when I saw the findings of a new study on parenting strategies and screen use among young adolescents, the first thing that jumped to my mind was Taylor Swift. It's me. Hi. I'm the problem. It's me. Yep, parent screen time influences how much kids use them. That was one of the study's key findings. Dr. Jason Nagata is a pediatrician at UC San Francisco and the study's lead author.
It's really important to role model screen behaviors for your children because one of the biggest predictors of your child or teenager's screen use is actually parents' screen use.
The study looked at data from more than 10,000 12 and 13-year-olds and their parents who were asked about their screen use habits, including texting, social media, video chatting, and watching and browsing online.
Even if teens say that they don't get influenced by their parents, the data does show that actually parents are a bigger influence than they may think.
Dr. Jenny Rudesky is a pediatrician at the University of Michigan who studies kids and digital media. She says she hears parents express feelings of guilt about their own screen use all the time.
Our immediate response is like,
I'm terrible. I'm so bad at this.
But instead of beating ourselves up, she says parents should realize that we too are vulnerable to technology that's deliberately designed to keep our attention glued.
We have been asked to parent around an increasingly complex digital ecosystem that's like actively working against our limit setting.
For ourselves and for our kids. But that doesn't mean we're completely powerless. Nagata's study found that keeping mealtimes and bedtimes screen-free are effective strategies. Interestingly, the study found that using screens as a reward or punishment actually backfired. It was linked to kids spending more time on their devices. Instead, researchers recommend parents work with their kids to come up with consistent family guidelines about when it's okay to use screens, and to question what we're really getting out of it whenever we feel compelled to keep scrolling. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This week in space was busy. It was also confusing because two brand new spacecraft launched, and they had pretty similar names. One is called Starliner. It carried two astronauts to the International Space Station. The other is called Starship, and it didn't have anyone on board, but one day it might carry people to the moon and to Mars. Joining me to try and keep these spaceships straight is NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfiel. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Scott.
A lot of skyrockets in flight this week.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed. You went there.
Well, on this afternoon, which would you like to start with, Starliner or Starship?
Well, let's start with Starliner, since that launched first. Mm-hmm. That has turned into a little bit of a summer travel nightmare for the two astronauts on board, Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams. First, this thing is way behind schedule. It was built by Boeing, whose airplanes have had their own problems lately. This isn't exactly related, but there have been all sorts of technical faults and glitches. They finally got on board in May, but there were more glitches, so they had to push it off by another month. And now, when they took off on Wednesday, it turned out they didn't get to have their luggage with them.
That feels like a problem with space travel.
Well, it's better than the alternative. They offloaded the suitcases of the astronauts to make room for an emergency urine pump for the space station's pee recycling system.
Also important.
Yes, also important. Finally, they get to the station. They're all lined up to dock and...
Looks like you're doing great flying there. We lost the first docking window.
They missed their docking window because of more problems. Five of the 28 thrusters didn't work as expected. Starliner was still able to dock, but it was an hour late, sort of a final travel injustice there.
Okay, so that's Starliner, now Starship. Tell me about that.
Okay, so Starship is built by Elon Musk's company SpaceX. And this could not be more different than the Starliner. It's this huge stainless steel machine. It's the biggest rocket ever built. It's so big that when it took off, it kind of broke the microphones. And this flight was wild. Nobody was aboard again, but Starship took off. It flew halfway around the world, and then it started re-entering the atmosphere. And as it did, it glowed white hot, and then Starship started to melt.
Yeah, it does appear that we have a little bit of burn through there. We can see pieces of the vehicle flying off.
This is wild to see this, but the ship is still coming down, which is incredible to see.
How far can it go? That is the question.
Now, this would normally obviously be a super bad thing, but this is how SpaceX loves to work. They test, you know, they break things, they test again. It's really effective. Starship got super beat up, but it actually did appear to survive re-entry.
All right, good news there.
And you can hear that even though this thing barely made it through its flight, everyone at SpaceX HQ was super happy.
So we have a melting spacecraft. We have a spacecraft that's delayed and has thruster issues. Both of them, in different ways, play key roles for the future of NASA. What happens next in these stories?
Well, Starliner, it's going to be on space station, and then it's going to return to Earth with its astronauts later this month.
hopefully that landing goes smoothly. And obviously there'll be a lot of introspection and looking into what went wrong. Mm-hmm. Starship, they're also going to look into what went wrong, but they're going to try and fix it really quickly and launch again just as fast as they can so they can learn again. It might be even within a month or two that they try flying that thing again.
With NPR's Jeff Bromfield, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org.
I'm Peter Sagal, and a huge surprise this week. Boeing launched a spacecraft into orbit. That's it. That's the surprise. Join us for the news quiz that never malfunctions. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
And it's coming up tonight at 6 o'clock, right after All Things Considered, then followed at 7 by...
I'm Ira Glass. Donald Trump's saying that if he gets back in office, he'll take retribution against his political enemies. Later today on This American Life, we look at what that really means.
If anybody spoke out against the president, I was the one issuing terrible statements, calling them a liar, saying they were looking for fame.
His former press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, who later turned against Trump, talks about what kind of retribution she expects from Trump if he takes office again. That's later today.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Biden is attending a state dinner in France today, saying that country was America's first friend at its founding and one of the U.S.'s closest allies more than 200 years later. On Thursday, he attended a ceremony honoring the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading back to the Middle East to work up support for a plan for a ceasefire in Gaza. He'll visit Egypt and Qatar and urge them to use their influence in the region to make it happen. And New York hosts the Cricket World Cup showdown tomorrow between India and Pakistan in one of the greatest rivalries of that sport. Cricket is one of the most watched sports in the world. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And by the listeners of KQED. Partly cloudy this evening, mostly cloudy overnight, and temperatures in the 50s. It's 5:41 now.
So All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Beauty pageant contestants have always been judged by their looks, and in recent decades, their do-gooderly deeds and their personalities. But one thing has remained consistent throughout beauty pageant history, and that's the fact that you generally had to be a human being to enter. That is now changing. Models created using generative artificial intelligence are competing in the inaugural Miss AI pageant this month. NPR's Chloe Veltman has been looking into it. Hey, Chloe.
Hi, Scott.
So what exactly are we talking about here?
Really, this is just a bunch of images on social media of extremely beautiful, sexy young women. Okay. But these are not real women, Scott. They are AI-generated models. They exist only on places like Instagram, mostly as stills, with accompanying written statements about their interests and their activities. And some of them can be seen moving and talking in videos. There's the Moroccan entry, Kenza Layli, speaking in Arabic about how proud she is to have been selected as a finalist for Miss AI.
Salam, jit nshark maakum wahed khabar zwin bzaf.
Even though these aren't real women, there is a real prize, $5,000 for the winner. And a lot of people are participating in this. There were 1,500 submissions, and now we're down to 10 finalists. A panel of judges will pick a winner at the end of the month.
So how exactly do you get from 1,500 to 1? What are the criteria here?
The AI beauty queens are judged from the content on their Instagram accounts, according to three criteria, Scott. So, of course, we've got looks, and there are also two other areas not typical for beauty pageants. One, how skillfully the AI tools have been used to create the models, for example, details around their eyes and hands, and also the avatar's social media reach, things like how many fans are commenting and reacting to the posts on social media, the audience growth rate, like the number of followers and how quickly you grow them.
And is there any depth to these models beyond what you just said, their appearance and their clout?
Well, appearance is still the main thing. Okay. All the 10 finalists fit in with the beauty queen stereotypes. They're young, they're buxom, they're female, they're all thin. Sally Ann Fawcett is one of the judges of this competition. She's a beauty pageant historian who's been judging these types of events for a long time. And she says she wishes there was more variety in the submissions for this contest.
I would like to see somebody of a different gender, somebody larger, older, with flaws. There's such a big scope, but I think because it's the first year, everyone's adhering to that typical stereotype of beauty.
Fawcett says she's been trying to focus her judging efforts on the messaging around these AI beauty queens. Like real-life pageants, the contestants talk about the good causes they support and so on. So, for example, you've got the French avatar, Anne Caldee, who's the brand ambassador for Oceanopolis Act, which is an ocean conservation fund. And then there's Romania's Iana Rainbow, who's an LGBTQ advocate.
There's a lot of different things to think about here. Who else have you talked to about what's going on here?
I wanted to get the take of somebody who understands feminism and technologies. So I spoke with Lynn Hirschman-Leeson, whose work is right at the intersection of these issues.
Yeah.
And she says she's baffled by the degree to which the AI creators for this contest so slavishly stick to traditional beauty pageanty tropes.
The AI world has such a range of possibilities to consider for attractiveness, and they've chosen in the top 10 to just look for some kind of surface resemblance to what's always been considered a winner in this kind of competition.
Hirschman-Leeson asked, why not do something more wild and creative with the technology? Like you could have a beauty queen who's a sea monster or one with five heads.
I mean, you could literally go any direction you want, and yet it is interesting that it ends up back in kind of this classic, almost tropey area.
Right. Well, also, let's give the AI creators some credit, Scott. It's not easy to create a photorealistic looking human, right, using AI.
Yeah.
But maybe more importantly, this isn't really a beauty contest at heart. Miss AI is really about showcasing AI as a marketing tool, specifically in the realm of AI influencers.
I confess I have not yet thought of what exactly an AI influencer could be.
Right. Well, most social media influencers today are real human beings, and it's a huge market, Scott. The influencer market is worth tens of billions of dollars, and it's growing fast. So the AI influencers, like the Miss AI finalists, could get in on this, and they're starting to become very popular, especially if they can look and act like humans. I spoke with Mohammed Tolha Saray, who's part of the team in Ankara, Turkey, that created one of the Miss AI finalists, Serenay. Saray says they came up with the AI model 5 or 6 months ago because they wanted a brand ambassador for their online jewelry company. They thought about hiring a human influencer, but they cost so much money and they're too demanding, he says. You can't control them. I know, people. You can't easily shape them to fit specific campaigns. Whereas, he says, his AI avatar is cheaper, more flexible, and she doesn't talk back.
With the AI, there's no limit. You can just do whatever you wanted. So just, I don't know, like if you want to just do something on the moon or on the sun, you can just do it on your imagination.
Saray says his business has grown tenfold since Serenay came on board to help his company sell jewelry. Her social media videos garner millions of views. He says he hopes the Miss AI beauty pageant will help grow her reputation as an influencer around the world. Also, Scott, he says it's telling that an astonishing number of people who comment on Serenay's post think she's a real human being.
So interesting. Maybe they're onto something here.
They could be.
NPR's Chloe Veltman, a human reporter. Thank you so much.
An actual human. Thanks, Scott.
Last year, saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin had an idea. Take the songs from her most recent album, Phoenix, reimagine them, and then play them live for a studio audience. This was not exactly a long simmering idea. It was almost, in the grand style of jazz, kind of improv.
I came up with the whole recording session probably 3 days before.
Wow.
And then I just called all the legends. I said, hey, you guys feel like jamming? They were like completely like, oh, I've been waiting for you to call, Keisha, let's do it.
Legends like trumpeter Randy Brecker and guitarist John Scofield. It was a bold move, but bold can describe a lot of Benjamin's career. Years ago, when the gigs were not as plentiful, she tried to stage crash Prince concerts until Prince took note and just invited her to play with his band. Today, Benjamin is one of the most innovative saxophonists in jazz. She got 3 Grammy nominations last year for Phoenix, and now the gigs are plentiful, including, the other day, one at NPR's Tiny Desk as we celebrate Black Music Month.
I sat down with Benjamin after her set. She had just played four songs from that new live album, which is called Phoenix Reimagined. It'll be coming out this summer. We started by talking about her songwriting process.
Usually first I think of the mood. Do I want to uplift people? Do I want to create a safe space? Do I want to create a happy space? What is the energy of the song? And then from there I'll go, okay, let's, we're mosh pitting this out.
Yeah.
Then I usually start, okay, the drums. I start on like my computer and start programming the beat how I want it to be. Then I start with the bass line. And then sometimes it comes and I hear the words first.
Uh-huh.
And then I say, okay, these words, like Mercy is a song we did. That's a song about just hoping that humanity can feel for each other and have some more empathy and have some an ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes.
That feels like a lot of the performance you just did felt like happy space to me, or felt like energetic space for sure. This is definitely one of the most energetic Tiny Desks that I've seen in a very long time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's kind of my vibe. My vibe is just to give people a place. You spend your dollars, you spend your money, or you just spend anything, give people a place that if you want to dance, dance free. If you want to be on your phone all the time, video me, be on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
But do what makes you feel happy and feels to be your authentic self. And I'm here to help you with that space. I feel like we need to go back to a time where artists kind of care about the audience.
Yeah.
Where it's not my job to just be a rock star. It's my job to kind of be a place for people to have an outlet.
You're talking about that 3-day period where you came up with the idea for Phoenix Reimagined. Tell me, what were you initially trying to do? Because your last album, Phoenix, got such great recognition. It was such a big moment. Going back and rethinking the same album is an interesting choice.
Yeah, you know, it actually usually takes me at least 2 years between an album to get into the new space for a new story and everything. And I just feel like because that year, 2023, had so many life-changing experiences for me with awards and accolades and just, I wanted to go back to the basics of what the music was before I moved forward again. Like, what brought me here? Play with some people that kick my butt, get me back into the grind. That's kind of why I made the song Let Go, just to remind myself, let go of the expectations people have for you. And if you get an award, you get it. If you don't get an award, you don't get it. But the people are what the music is here for, so don't stop my, I guess, searching for that thing. And I got so inspired by it that I just called everybody. I said, let's go, man. And I don't have a live album, so I was like, let's get the people something to hear how we really get out.
Yeah.
Let go.
Let go.
Let it flow,
let it flow,
let it glow,
let it glow.
It's all for show and hopes and empty jokes.
Which gets to such the thing that everyone says about jazz, that it is what it is when it's live. Like, what to you, how do you explain the difference between a live jazz performance and listening to something that, you know, you maybe put together over the course of a week in a studio? Like, how do you explain that difference?
I guess in the studio, you're trying to, like, perfect something that will exist forever, something that will sonically hold weight and value forever. And live, you are mastering the experience. This is an interaction between them and you. You know, so it can change each time. It can grow. It flows a little differently. You have the space that if we change the people in this room, we change now the show. Whereas on a studio recording, you're like, this is the perfect version. And that's what it is forever, you know?
Let's go searching and clinging to your fears. Deep down in your mind, do the empty, broken thoughts linger? Will you pay to pray to keep the limelight? It doesn't sit right because folks in suits, they keep me so uptight.
So I wanted an album to show that we are still kind of growing and rising and figuring out who we are, but we're in a transitional season. So I wanted people to see this is our new space of where we are. And if you thought it was over, nah.
When you talk about a new season, I did want to ask about something that's gotten a lot of attention with you, and that was that really scary car crash a few years ago that you got into coming back from a gig. You broke your jaw, which as a saxophonist, I feel like is an existential problem in addition to just being a really scary health situation.
Yeah, totally.
How much did that affect the music that you composed and played since?
Completely.
Yeah.
Because, that was when the pandemic, I guess you could say, was kind of raging and they were canceling all the shows. So they had, in the summer, allowed all of these shows. So we had kind of like 2 or 3 a week, and I was driving back from Ohio. And I'm listening to the song, I'm jamming, I'm vibing, the sunrise is coming up. It was so beautiful. And the next thing I know, I'm covered in blood. And someone is like trying to drag me, and they're dragging me through the mud. In that instance, I didn't know, was I going to live? I was in so much pain. Cops are coming, ambulance is coming. I'm kind of fading in and out of consciousness. I remember asking the ambulance guy, am I going to be okay? And he told the driver to drive faster. And I was like, ooh, pass out.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's not a good answer.
Yeah, you go from like, okay, am I going to live? Okay, yeah, I am. Am I going to play the saxophone again? Yeah, I am. Then you go, okay, am I going to make music again? All the music to Phoenix is coming to my head nonstop. And then you go to 3 Grammy nominations. You know, so I just wanted people to see, like, what happens if the odds go completely against you and you don't stop? You know, don't decide for yourself your destiny. Let God decide where you go. As long as, and you do the work to keep going and let the universe open the doors.
It seems like that is really, really important to you, this idea of having a dream and keeping working at it and pushing forward, even if it feels like you're hitting some resistance, and just saying, you know what, I don't, that doesn't matter. I'm just going to keep doing it.
Yeah, I kind of feel like whenever I feel fear, I know it's the right road. Every time I do something that's impossible and it happens, you get a little stamp of like, oh, that kind of worked. Mm-hmm. Every time, you know, when I used to jump on Prince's stage, I got the gig.
Yeah.
You know, so what's better, to wonder and sit in regret or to do something? I always push my students too to go somewhere and say, hey, just come with me. And when it happens, they go, it worked out. I'm like, yeah. What if you push a little further? You know, you build up a kind of self-esteem that is unmatchable. You know, that's what we want little girls and little boys to know, that it's all possible in a world that's full of darkness.
The last thing I wanted to ask about was the last song you played, Train. Can you tell us about just the deep connection and the deep inspiration that you feel from John and Alice Coltrane?
Oh my God. I mean, I feel like that's how they think about life and music is how I think about it. So they're masters at their instruments. There's no higher level, some can say, for saxophone and for Alice Coltrane, harp, piano, organ. And at the same time, they've kind of mastered like the human part of life.
Yeah.
You know, spiritual gurus, leaders, authors, they care about people. They're making music and purpose and leaving a legacy behind. So when I look at a role model that musically is sane, and then their life was something that a life that I would be proud to live, that's what I think of, you know. So I'm always thinking about them. I'm always thinking when I play, I hope this could be, if they were sitting here, I could give this gift to them and say thank you, you know.
When we were reading up on all the conversations you've had about your work, there was one quote that made us all laugh. When we were talking about you were drawn to Alice first, mm-hmm. and just reading the liner notes and seeing John Coltrane mentioned, and you said, oh, she must have a brother.
Totally did. I read that. It was like something like all peace and power to John Coltrane. I was like, okay, brother. So I went on Google and looked for him, and, you know, the whole Wikipedia comes up. I was like, oh my God, man has like 100 albums or something. So I felt stupid. But in that process, I was like, you know what? I put all the albums on the discography in order. And I went and got all those albums in that order. And I listened to his whole life from that place all the way to the end. So when I got to the end, because I had heard all of Alice Coltrane's music, I felt like I really understood how they came together. Because I saw his life before I knew her life. And then at the moment they connect, you could really see, oh, they were kind of both on this little journey and everything. So I do think it gives me a little advantage that I don't have the Coltrane sound in my head when I play.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm never trying to be like Coltrane. I'm just trying to be inspired by him.
Lakeisha Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
And you can see her entire Tiny Desk performance, along with all of the other Black Music Month performances, throughout June at NPR.org.
That's All Things Considered for this Saturday. Thanks for listening. We will catch you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism. Available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners of KQED. Joe Salvatore is here for his first look at the roadways for us tonight, and we're starting in Pleasanton. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sandy. This is eastbound 580 at Hacienda Drive. This is a crash that's involving three cars and a motorcycle, and this is blocking the second and third lanes from the left, and traffic is backing up quickly. It is now stopped from the Dublin interchange. The other crash we have right now is in San Francisco. This is southbound 101 at Candlestick Point. Two cars involved in this crash. It is blocked back. Let me start that again. A two-car